Joshua chapter 3. Joshua chapter 3. This is our, and I'll just tell you guys now so you know for next week, this is our last, interruption to your regularly scheduled broadcast. So next Sunday, we'll be in the back again with coffee and pastries and what have you, and we'll be starting in on the Gospel of John, and we'll be doing that for the next however long it takes us. 3 months or 3 years or probably realistically somewhere in between. Don't really know, but I'm really looking forward to it, and we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a moment. John, can you go check and see if my notes have printed yet by any chance? I figured probably, but if you could, just keep an eye on that. All right, so I might be doing this without notes this morning, which will be fine too. Joshua chapter 3. This is actually, some of you who were here might recognize a couple of things. This is actually a little bit of a recycled lesson. I try not to do those usually, but this is my obligatory New Year resolutions lesson. This is what this is going to be. Hopefully, it won't be typical. It probably won't be like New Year's resolutions lessons you've heard before. And certainly, I've significantly updated the content from last time. You'll be happy to know there's more medieval illuminated manuscripts this time around. So it's going to be different. Okay, Joshua chapter 3. We're actually going to read Joshua chapter 3 a good deal. It's a pretty short chapter, so we're going to read into chapter 4. It says, Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to the Jordan. He and all the people of Israel lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. And there shall be a distance between you and it about 2,000 cubits, which is cubits about 18 inches, about a foot and a half, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you shall have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua said to the priest, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. The Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand, stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing before you into the Jordan. Now therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with their priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, the feet of the priest bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the water. Now the Jordan overflows all of its banks throughout the time of harvest. The waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down toward the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jordan. Now the priests, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. When all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. Then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man for each tribe. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the Ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, what do those stones mean to you? then you shall tell them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. And the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they are there to this day, for the priests bearing the Ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished, that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. Skipping down to verse 19. The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know, Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you, until you had passed over as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that the people of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. All right. So in Joshua chapter 3, we have the children of Israel. They've come to the end of 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. It's been 40 years, and an entire generation of people has been lost. Now think about what this means for a moment. All right, this means that with the exception of Moses and Joshua, that there is nobody, Moses, Joshua, and Caleb actually, that there's nobody, and obviously Moses has just died, so now it's just Joshua and Caleb. There's nobody else that can say, well, you know, back in my day, in Egypt, we had to make bricks without straw and carry them uphill both ways in the snow. Right? There's no older people. The oldest people in the nation of Israel, other than Joshua and Caleb, are about 40 years old. Right? This is an entire nation of people who are pretty young, and they've never known anything other than wandering in the wilderness. Now let that sink in for a moment. As they originally came out of Egypt, led by Charlton Heston, now I guess Christian Bale, as they originally came up out of Egypt, led by Moses, the people of Israel had spent their entire lives in Egypt, which is kind of known. And you know, the Jews don't, the Hebrews didn't have it awesome because they were slaves, but they didn't have it horrible either. And that's that, like, they were oppressed, but they were, it's sort of like, you know, you're oppressed, but you're oppressed on Long Beach, or you're oppressed, but it's in Southern California. Like, Egypt is the resort. It's the spa of that part of the world. Like, it's known, it was known all the way up till Roman times and beyond that for its decadence and its luxury and the pleasant climate, which is pretty pleasant if you're living on the Nile Valley. And we're told that God prospered the people of that prospered the Hebrews in the land of Goshen, and God prospered their crops and their animals and all these other things. And that they did have crops and animals. Like, they did own some stuff. They were servants, they were slaves, but they did own some stuff. And so their life wasn't awesome. It was pretty good. And so those people coming out of Egypt, and they spend 40 years wandering in the wilderness, and because of their disobedience, you know, they lose an entire generation. And it's an entire generation of people who had served the gods of Egypt, an entire generation of people who every time something got rough or they got a little bit tired of manna, they said, you know what, man, I would really kill for the leeks and the onions, which just sounds like heartburn to me, but I would really kill for the leeks and the onions of Egypt right now. The hearts of people who repeatedly were turning back to Egypt, repeatedly turning back to the gods that they had worshipped while they were in Egypt before Moses came to deliver them, a generation is completely gone. And in its place, we have a generation of faith. And it's a generation of faith because this is not a generation of people who has seen Egypt or the miracles that God worked to bring Israel out of Egypt, But nor have they seen the promised land. Nobody's seen the promised land. So they don't know what they're going to. They don't really know where they come from. What they do know is that they've spent their entire life, 40 years, wandering in the wilderness. And every day, the only way that they've been fed is that God sends down manna from heaven 6 days a week, every morning. And they gather that up. And they cook it. And that's what they eat. And the only thing they know is that every time they get thirsty, there's a rock, and that rock follows them, and Moses speaks to the rock, strikes it in some cases, and the rock gushes forth water, and Paul tells us that rock followed them wherever they went, and that the rock was Christ. So here's the thing. This is an entire generation of a nation of people who have spent their lives fed and watered on the food of angels and the water of the Son of God. And they have been told that they're headed for a promised land, but they've never seen it. So this is a generation of tremendous faith. It has been roughly five generations now since a descendant of Abraham has seen the land of Canaan. It's been a long time since anybody's been to the promised land. So this is a generation that's grown up in the wilderness. The only thing they've ever known is the daily provision of God. They've had to rely on God for their daily provision of food in the wilderness. And this has raised them to be this generation of great faith, a generation that's really ready to go and obey God's command and conquer the promised land, unlike their fathers who turned back. And they said, there's giants in the land, and they turned back. So by faith, they followed Joshua after Moses' death. They followed Joshua over into the promised land, about which they've only ever heard from their parents and from the leaders of the nation. And as they reach the Jordan River, which is the border of this promised land, they find the river, which is usually just kind of a muddy stream. But one time a year, and it doesn't do this anymore because of irrigation and such, but one time a year in those days, in the spring, after the snow on the mountain starts to melt and it runs down into the Jordan River swells, overflows its banks, and the Jordan River runs through a valley called the Jordan River Valley, and basically it just starts filling the valley up. And so they come to the Jordan River, which is usually a pretty small stream, wouldn't be a big deal to cross, and now it's big. Now it's full. Now it's a pretty significant river, and it's going to be a significant, undertaking to get hundreds of thousands of people across this river. Not impossible, but it's going to be a bit of work. In ancient times, by the way, crossing rivers with large numbers of people was one of the main problems you had to solve if you were an engineer. And they did have engineers in ancient times, and they weren't really building suspension bridges or writing software. What they were typically doing was trying to figure out how do we get a large body of people, usually soldiers, across this body of water. And they came up with lots of ingenious ways to do this, and inflated animal skins and pontoon bridges and bridges of boats, and some of them just really failed catastrophically. So we've got this problem, and instead of Joshua saying, all right, let's build a bridge, you guys, or all right, let's inflate some animal skins and build a bridge of pontoons across. Instead of that, God says, Joshua, all right, have the priests take the ark, wade out into the middle of the river. And the priests do this. And the water stops. It actually stops way upstream at the town of Adam. And the Bible says it just continues to grow and piles and piles and piles up. And the water just continually piles up. And think about this. If you're one of the Canaanite inhabitants of the land living in the city of Adam, and you get up one morning and you go outside the town to do your farming or whatever else it is you do, out there. And you're going down to the river for some water. And I can just see, little Susie goes out to the river to get a bucket of water for mom. And she gets to the water and she just sort of looks. And here's this river. It's been piling up all night long because it takes more than a day for several hundred thousand people to cross a river. People and their cattle and everything else. And little Susie gets to the river, and the river's just piling up. And she drops her bucket, and she runs back and says, Mom, you're never going to believe what I saw. And sure enough, Mom doesn't believe it. And then some other people come, and they look. And word starts to get around. This is why the people of Jericho as soon as the Israelites show up, they shut their gates. They're terrified because this huge host of people just arrived from Egypt and the water gets out of their way. Think about that for a moment. And so as a verification of their faith, God does for Joshua what he did for Moses. He parts the water. And the people of Israel go over on dry ground. But as he does this, something interesting and kind of unique happens. And what we just read in Joshua chapter 4, they make two memorials. The first memorial, they take up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan where the priests are standing. They have one man from each tribe go in and get one stone. And we're talking, these are pretty good-sized stones. These are not pebbles. These are not, you know, softballs. These are really good-sized stones, flat stones, smooth stones, stones that the river has been running over for maybe centuries. And they get these big, smooth, flat stones, and they bring them up out of this now dry riverbed, and they lay them down on the other side of the Jordan at Gilgal, which is a city or a settlement just on the other side of the Jordan, on the west side of the Jordan bank. And they lay those stones down, 12 of them, and they basically build an altar. Now, there's actually a very specific formula for building altars out of stones in the Bible, and that is you take 12 stones that have not been worked on by tools, not been worked on by the hand of man. You take 12 stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel, and you pile them up and you make an altar. And that's basically what they do. They make a really big altar, or maybe kind of a short pillar out of these stones. Then they make another memorial. They take 12 stones off of the east bank, where they just came from, and they bring those down into the riverbed, and they pile them up. Now, keep in mind that except for about once a year, the Jordan's pretty low. So most of the year, you're going to be able to see this pillar that has now been set in the middle of the river. And here's what Joshua tells them. It says, in later days, when a generation grows up, that is not the generation of faith. Remember, this is an entire generation of Israelites who've been fed and watered, literally, by God every single day. In the most literal sense imaginable of that, they've been fed and watered by God every single day. And as soon as they get into the land of Canaan, in fact, immediately after this crossing, Joshua goes on to tell us in a little bit, the manna stops. There's no more manna. There's no more rock following them around, and now they have to live and eat off of the produce of the land of Canaan. And there's a warning in the law, and the warning says, when you come into the land that I promised to your fathers, and you start tending vineyards and growing crops and enjoying the fruits of your labor, that you will be tempted to take credit for that yourself. Don't, because as soon as you do that, you're going to forget me, and that's when judgment starts. But the thing is, that generation is coming. That generation that has only ever lived off of the fruit of their own labors and the work that their parents put into the land. And they haven't been fed by manna and watered by this rock that follows them every single day. That generation is coming. And so Joshua sets up two memorials. He sets up two piles of stone. And he says, here's what... And he says, here's what you're going to do. Someday your children and your children's children will ask you, Grandpa, what do those stones mean? And you're going to say, tell them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it passed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, so these stones shall be to the people a memorial forever. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan in the place where the feet of the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. So Joshua sets up these two memorials, and it's to remind the people of Israel in days to come, the generations of people who are not yet born, the mighty works that God wrought to bring the people of Israel out of slavery and into the land of promise. Now, let me induce a little whiplash here and talk about the Mayans. You may remember a couple of years ago, the Mayans got a whole lot of press back in 2012. In fact, this is like the 2-year anniversary of the Mayans being wrong about the end of the world. But the Mayans got a whole lot of press, and I say it's an inordinate amount of press. They got a whole lot more press than we usually give most extinct civilizations. Like, usually that's, it's like niche knowledge, but the Mayans made it into like the mainstream news. And the reason they had made it into mainstream news is that some people who can't read Mayan hieroglyphs, which is probably most of us, read the Mayan, one of the Mayan long cycle calendars wrong, and thought that the Mayans predicted the end of the world in 2012, and like some of the people who are, I guess, are hanging pyramids around their necks and doing the crystals and everything else were pretty sure that the world was going to end, and that was making the news, and it's all silly. And we got this picture, this cracked me up, we got this picture in the news a whole lot. Does anybody remember seeing this? Okay. This is not even a calendar. Alright, this is the Aztec Stone of the Sun. It has nothing to do with the Mayans, let alone the Mayan calendar, but this is the image that got put in the news. Every single news article about this, and 2 years ago, it drove me up the wall. But anyway, so that's the thing is that the Mayans and the Aztecs both had several calendars, none of which predicted anything remotely like the end of the world. But there is another Mayan artifact, another genuine work of Mayan art, and we talked about this a couple of years ago, and I'm going to talk about it again this morning, and that's this. This is one of many handprints in the handprint cave in Mexico, or in Belize, rather, excuse me. This is where a cave where ancient Mayans left several different handprints on the wall by making what's called a negative. And this is blowing, basically, they would put their hand on the... It's like if you took your hand and you put it on the wall and then you just spray paint around the hand and the hand becomes a stencil for a negative image. So you pull back and there's paint everywhere except where you put your hand. So they did that, but instead of spray paint, they blew like dye through a tube. Okay. And there's a cave in Belize that is full of these handprints where some Mayan artist was like, this would be pretty cool. I'm going to leave my handprints all over the wall of this cave. There are a whole lot more offensive things he could have left on the wall of the cave, just based on public restrooms I've been in. So, you know, this is fine. So he left this handprint of the wall on the cave. And the thing is, we don't know anything about the man who did this other than the shape of his, size of his hand. All right, we don't know anything about the man who did this or really what he was like or even really why he was like, this would be a good idea. I don't, was he living in the cave? Is this Mayan interior decorating? Nobody knows. But what we do know about him is that he left a permanent marker. He left something of himself for those who would come after. He left a handprint. A handprint is a tangible reminder to his descendants and to us, not knowing anything else about this guy. We know that he was human, that he lived, that he existed, and that he wanted to leave something behind. Now, in his own way, he's doing something really similar, or at least conceptually similar, to what Joshua was doing at Gilgal, setting up those two stone monuments. But there's a really important key difference between those two, and I want you to try and see if you can figure out what it is, and then I'll tell you at the end of this lesson. All right? So, stone pillars at Gilgal, handprints in Belize. Everybody with me so far? Okay. So these stones at Gilgal, Joshua orders that stones be brought up out of the Jordan River, heaped in a mound or an altar. And this is at Gilgal, which is the first encampment in the Promised Land, just east of Jericho. And the purpose of this mound is clearly stated, and that is to leave a memorial for the generations who come later of what God has done for Israel. Now, the 24th, Christmas Eve, was my sister Christiana's birthday. My birthday was almost a week before that. Every year, because I like making people uncomfortable, like it's just, there's no way around it, I like watching people squirm. Every year for each of my siblings' birthday, I have a question that I ask them that they're never prepared to answer. That's not true. Sometimes they are, but usually they're not expecting it. I try to blindside them. It's like they've just blown out the candles, you know, and then I ask them the question when they're not expecting to answer it, because I don't like watching people squirm. And what's the question, guys? Right. What are you going to do differently this year than what you did from what you did last year? And the reason I ask that question is because if you don't change what you're doing, you can't actually expect anything else about you to change, right? If you don't change the things you're doing, like, I guess the first question is, do you feel like there's a need to change? If you don't, then maybe you need to look a little closer at yourself or ask some people in your family. But no. Actually, it's probably a good idea. But if you want something to change, or you want to change something about yourself, you have to change what you're doing. And if you don't, why would you expect anything to change? Why would you think the rules work differently for you? Why would you think that you can just keep doing what you're doing and things will get better? So, something I like to ask my siblings each year is, what are you going to do differently in the next year of your life from what you did this last year? Now, it's that time of year when collectively we're all making resolutions about the coming year. Things like, I want to lose weight. Things like, I want to watch less television. Whatever else it is. And what I want to do with the remaining time this morning is looking at these examples of the pillars and then the handprint. I want to encourage you to make a couple of resolutions this year. And they're not about weight loss or watching less television, though those are both good things. You should maybe consider them. I don't know. I'm not... Wow, that was... Well, anyway, if you were already planning on one or the other of those, please don't let me get in the way of that. But I want to encourage you to a couple of resolutions that are spiritual. And here they are. The first thing I want to encourage you to do is to make public memorials. Now, what do I mean by that? The memorial at Gilgal is intentionally public. One of the ways that we pass faith on to subsequent generations is through setting up landmarks. And a landmark is something that reminds us of God's faithfulness, but more importantly, it's something that outlasts us. Joshua will die, but this pile of stones is going to be there longer than Joshua. Now, it is up to subsequent generations to maintain the landmark. And that's a real problem that we have as people. Like in the Bible, one of the recurring things we see is that when people fall into sin, it's because they've forgotten what God has done. But the whole purpose of the landmark is to forestall that as long as possible. It's to create a public reminder of the way that God has, of a way that God has been faithful to you and to your family. But the thing about the memorial at Gilgal is it's not merely a reminder of God's greatness and goodness. It's also a reminder of a really specific way in which the power of God was experienced by the people of God while acting out the faith of God. All right? It's a reminder not just of generally God is good, God is great. This is a reminder of a really specific way that God has dealt with us. The children of Israel had only the word of Joshua to tell them what awaited them when they got on the other side of the Jordan. So crossing for them is an act of great faith. This is a generation of great faith. And they cross into the promised land. And the first thing Joshua does, he puts up these memorials as a testimony to the power of God when the people of God act in faith. So a biblical memorial it's a reminder of a specific way that the power of God has been experienced by the people of God while acting out of faith in God. And this kind of memorial, in my opinion, is one of the highest purposes of the arts. One of the things that we've done historically as human beings is when something really major happens, we erect a memorial to it. So dotted all across the southeastern United States, where I spent a lot of time vacationing growing up, there are memorials to a war that we had, the Civil War. And you can go to Vicksburg, you can go to Gettysburg, you can go to a million places in between where there are memorials to men who fought and died. Sometimes against their own family, sometimes against their own brothers. And for some reason, one of the only things that we tend to put up memorials to is war. I don't really get that. I mean, I get it, but... In Thanksgiving Square, which is it's located immediately outside my window in downtown Dallas, where I work. Thanksgiving Square, there are two small obelisks, and then a large spiral-shaped chapel, which, in my opinion, is one of the uglier buildings designed by man. It's not a very attractive building at all. But it's Thanksgiving Chapel, and it's actually quite pretty on the inside. There's stained glass, and the sun comes through and everything. And it was erected by the founders of the city of Dallas at some point in the past as a memorial to the goodness of God. And as you walk around Thanksgiving Square, on each of those four obelisks, on each of the four corners, and they're very small little obelisks, but on each obelisk, on each corner of the square there, there's a Bible verse and then a quote from a president. And there are quotes from presidents Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and I think Roosevelt. And there are quotes that are each from those respective presidents' declaration of days of thanksgiving to God on the part of the nation. And it's a neat reminder, and there are bells, and the bells ring once per hour, ring on the hour. And it's this neat reminder in the middle of downtown Dallas of where it all comes from. Now, it may not be the most aesthetically attractive reminder, being built in a postmodern architectural style, but it's a memorial, nonetheless, to the goodness of God. So one of the things that we've done historically as humans is we build memorials, we build reminders for ourselves of important things that happened. This is one of the highest purposes of art, to remind us of the goodness of God. What these reminders look like in your family, is going to depend on your own family culture, but these can be things like hanging up a plaque on this day, this happened, get it burned in wood, spend some money on it, keeping a family prayer journal that's accessible to the family, that maybe you sit down at the end of each year and you say, here are the things that we prayed and the way that God answered these prayers this year, things like that. In other words, creating public memorials for this church, for our families, of ways that God has answered and moved and worked in the lives of his people. So that's the first thing I would encourage you to do this year. And get creative about it. Like, I'm just looking out on you right now. We have some of the most creative people in the world in this room right now, okay? And you guys can probably think up some really creative ways that are significant to your family or specifically significant to your church to remember ways that God has blessed you or ways that God has answered specific prayers. So be thinking about that and be thinking about how you're going to do that in 2015. I think this would be really okay, because it's so easy to get discouraged, right? So easy to be discouraged. It's easy to be discouraged here on church staff because, you know, you're dealing with problems. And a lot of the times when people come to you, and you guys are not like this, okay? Nobody in this room is like this. But a lot of times when you're on church staff, when people come to you, it's just to complain, or it's just because they have a problem, or it's just because somebody's hurt their feelings. And it can be discouraging to be on church staff. And it is one of the most, I think it would be building to our faith if, as a church, we could come up with some ways to remember the good things. Because sometimes usually it's only the bad stuff that sticks in our memory. So that's the first thing I want to encourage you to do is make public memorials. Now, public memorials are for the people around you, but they exist even more importantly for future generations. It's these generations that are in the greatest danger of losing sight of what God has done in the lives of their forebears. And this is why the fact that we have the journals of so many great men and women of God is a tremendously important thing. And it's why the fact that almost none of us journal, unless you're my sister Faith, because like she journals like it's like a million pages a year or something, but the fact that most of us aren't journaling, aren't writing down what God is doing for us, like that's a problem. Why is that a problem? Because we are, you know what? We do journal. We totally do journal. But the stuff we journal about is eating delicious cheeseburger, send location to Facebook. The things we journal about are, oh man, I feel horrible today. Oh no, not another Monday. Really enjoyed this movie that I saw. And we do journal. We journal in 140 character status updates. And if those things survive in another 150 years, which I very much doubt, but let's say they do. Let's say they do. And someday, we've got laid out before us, future generations have laid out before them in one, on one side of the table, they've got I'm trying to pick a diary of a great Christian at random here, but John Adams. Yeah, I was really trying to think of somebody other than John Adams because he's like my favorite person, but okay. All right, we'll go with John Adams. All right. So on one side of the table, we have like the personal diary of John Adams, and on the other side of the table, we have all of Richard's status updates. One of those things is going to be more eternally significant and impactful for future generations than the other one. All right? So, and I'm not saying, like, just be writing, okay, future generations, here are the things to avoid, though that might actually not be a horrible idea. But we need to keep in mind that the things we do, as we're thinking about memorials and things that we want to do, whether it's keeping a prayer journal, which I think is a great idea, and honestly, if you're going to do something like that, establish a culture of preserving things, of stewardship and custodianship in your family, for taking care of those things and preserving them for future generations. This is something, by the way, that my mom's family, Grant, your pastor and his wife, that they've done a great job of. We were sitting around the other day reading poems written by my great-great-grandfather that he wrote about my grandfather and his brothers and cousins when they were all boys. And it was the coolest thing. And it was neat to see, you know, that here's my great-great-grandfather, and he's a man of God, and he's somebody who loves the Lord, and he wants to see his children love the Lord. And you can hear that passion in the stuff he wrote when he was an old man. And we still have that. And that's a great thing. So just be thinking about what are the ways that you can keep the faith and preserve it in such a way that it will mean something to generations that come. Okay. The memorial in the middle of the Jordan is only visible at times when the water is low, and I think that's really important, okay? And this is the second resolution, and that is have a personal testimony. Personal testimonies may be less visible than a public memorial, but they can be just as impacting. Your personal testimony should be of what God has done as well as what he is doing in your life right now, which means you actually have to like be spending some time with God. Like this stuff has to actually be changing you in order for you to have a testimony about it. Now, what a testimony is most certainly not is a list of all the ways Richard is a great Christian. Okay? That's the other thing. Fortunately, there's a really great template for us of what a biblical testimony looks like. It's in Psalm 78. I'm not going to read the whole psalm this morning just for time's sake, but let me give you the highlights. A biblical testimony has a threefold purpose. The first purpose is to teach us to set our hope in God rather than in ourselves. And that's in Psalm 78, verse 7. The second purpose is to keep us mindful of his mighty works so that we will better keep his commandments. And the third purpose is to prevent a backsliding attitude that results when God's power is forgotten. These are the purposes of a biblical testimony. So, step number one, if you're thinking, man, I feel like God has really been working in my life, and I would like to share this with people, a really good question to ask yourself to make sure this isn't just an ego trip is, am I accomplishing one of these three things? Okay? All right, I'm going to give everybody another quick moment to write those down. So a God-honoring testimony has a threefold purpose. All right, a God-honoring testimony also has a heavenward focus. We have to be very careful that when we give our testimony, we keep it God-centered and God-focused. It should not be your story, but rather it should be the story of how the mighty works that God has done in your life despite your flesh. The whole of Psalm 78 reflects this truth, by the way. This is the story of the mighty things that God did for Israel, despite the fact that they kept forgetting him and turning away from him. It says, how oft did they provoke him in the wilderness and grieve him in the desert? Yea, they turned back and tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. So, a godly testimony has a heavenward focus. It also has a well-ordered presentation, and the outline of Psalm 78 goes like this. There's a problem, verses 18 and 19. And then there's God's grace for the difficulty, verses 23 to 25. And then there's how I resisted, or how the nation of Israel resisted God's grace, verses 29 to 33. And then finally, how I, or how the nation of Israel accepted God's grace in verse 34. And then finally, there's an end result, verse 35. And that's the narrative of the testimony of the nation of Israel that's given to us in Psalm 78. By the way, what's the reason for Psalm 78? Starts at the beginning and says, I will open up my mouth and utter dark sayings of old. In other words, I'm going to speak of things that happened long in the past so that those who are yet unborn will know the power of God. It's in the first three verses of the psalm. And then finally, a God-honoring testimony has a victorious life. We know from the rest of the Bible that the change of heart on the part of Israel is temporary. It only lasts a generation. It's one rotation of this cycle that repeats itself. But, at least in this chapter, it is a cycle that ends well. David is on the throne at the end of Psalm 78, and he goes on from shepherding sheep to leading the people of Israel, according to Psalm 78, in the integrity of his heart. No matter how many times we've strayed from God in the past, our testimony can still be vibrant and powerful if we are currently living a victorious life through the grace of Jesus Christ. If our lifestyle lacks victory, and I want to be really, really careful here, because I am not saying if you want to come to church, you have to have your act together, because that's not the purpose of church. This isn't where a lot of people who have their acts together come to agree about everything, right? That's whatever else we're here for, that's not it. But what I am saying is that if you're in a place in your life where you're not living in victory against sin or against whatever it is that's really tearing you down and destroying you right now, it's not time for your testimony. It's time for repentance. It's time for humility. It's time for confession. It's time to get with your brothers and sisters in Christ and say, I'm going through a hard time. And it's time for them to come around you and lift up the wounded. All right, there is a time for that. I'm not saying you always have to have your act together. In fact, I promise you, in 2015, you won't. But to have a God-honoring testimony, it ends in victory. It ends in a victorious life. Now, a minute ago, I talked about a handprint. All of human society is predicated around one idea. And the idea is that we need to leave something for the people that come after us. If you remember in the book of, I guess it's 2 Samuel, when we were reading about Absalom, we know Absalom had a son and a daughter, and at some point something happened and the son dies. And so Absalom has a pillar erected for himself in the land of Israel. And so basically he builds a big monument to himself. Why? Because he has no sons. Because when he dies, there will be no one left to carry on his name, and he desperately needs to be remembered. All of human society, all of the decisions that we make are made around the idea that we want to leave something for the people who come after us. Okay, that's one of the foundations of, like, this is why marriage is important. This is why we have children. This is why we raise the children. This is why we build monuments and memorials. And this is why we make art. It's all to make something that outlasts us here on this earth. This is the defining feature of our humanity. It's the hallmark of civilization. And there are some things that will outlive you. Now, again, I want to be careful, because work is important, and the work that we do is important. And you guys have heard me say it, and I'll say it again. There are people who teach that the only good work is Christian work. And I think that's wrong, and I think that's dangerous. And it gets us to a place where we have a really dangerous theology of work, where we think that what Richard is doing right now is way more important than what you do at your job on Monday, And that's not the case. The only good work, the only Christian work is good work done well. And whatever you do, whatever vocation God has called you to, Paul says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all as to the Lord and not unto man. But there are some things that we can do that will last longer than others, and that's okay. All right? Doesn't mean that, you know, if your work, if your day job isn't one of these things, it doesn't mean that that's unimportant. But there are some things that we can do that will outlast us. The words that we leave, we talked about journaling a moment ago. Some of us are word people, and it's really easy for us word people to act like, to really treat it like words are the most important things in the universe, and I do that all the time. If you're not word people, it's okay. All right? Because I'll talk to you in a moment. But the words that you leave, the journaling, things that you write, things that you leave, I think it's tremendously awesome that I can read a poem that my great-great-granddad wrote about my grandfather. And someday, in my wildest dreams, my great-great-grandchildren will be reading all those funny little poems that great-great-granddad Richard wrote when he thought nobody was looking. All right, and that's going to be, I think that would be tremendous. Words that you leave, but also the disciples that you make. And can I just say that if you're not leaving anything else, if you're not word people and you can't journal and it's really difficult for you to write a sentence, that's okay. Because there are other things that, there are other ways that you can leave something that outlasts you. And maybe the most important one is what Jesus commanded, go into the world and make disciples, baptizing, teaching them all the things that I have commanded you. And if nothing else, the disciples that you make, whether it's your children, or if you don't have children, whether it's just the people whose lives you've invested in, that is a legacy that you can leave that will last longer than you do. And that's one of the most tremendous things when you're thinking about eternity, is that it's really easy to look at people and say, man, Pastor Dale has done so much for God, and Pastor Dale has accomplished so much. But before him, there was somebody who shared the gospel at the Shinnery Lake Baptist Church. And there was his mother and his father and his family constantly planting the seed of the gospel. And there were people before them who did that. And there were people before them who did that. And there were people before them who did that. And every single one of those people gets to share in everything that your pastor has done for the kingdom of God. The disciples that you make, the words that you speak into other people's life, the encouragement that you give them, bringing that meal after somebody's just had their baby, that stuff really does matter. It does matter. And I want you to really understand, it's so easy. Okay? And sometimes I think I'm the worst at this because it's easy to get to thinking, okay, well, I'm teaching, and so, you know, it's, you know, I put in my time for God this week. Okay, but it's really easy to get discouraged about all that little stuff because it seems like you're just running around and you're doing it and you're helping people and you're bringing meals and you're doing kitchen prep and it's just, it's easy to get lost in the weeds and forget that that stuff matters, that good work done well matters to God. And it doesn't just matter to God, it matters to your kids, and it matters to the people who are inspired by your example. There's also the art that you create. Now, I know there are different kinds of art. I'm going to talk about visual art for a minute, but there's, you know, writing is an art, poetry is an art, music is an art. And if you're an art person, any one of those things, or I don't know, like, you know, pebble sculptures or underwater ball bearing stacking or whatever else it is you do. Okay. Some of you are going to get the underwater ball bearing stacking in about 10 minutes. It's going to be awesome. Whatever it is that you do, art matters. Art is something that God gave us. God is an artist. I firmly 100% believe that God is an artist. I have seen sunsets. I know it's true. Art is something that God gave us, and it's not something that we're very good at handling, or at least we haven't been in the last 150 years. It's not something we're very good at handling as Christians. Like, we don't always know what to do with it. And it's because there's a lot of bad art. And so sometimes instead of just rejecting the sin, we reject the medium and we're afraid of it. We don't deal with it. And so we don't have that we're not leaving those legacies in whatever medium it is that you work in. We're not leaving those legacies for the people who come after us. I want to show you two pages from some medieval illuminated manuscripts. Now, some of you are like, I don't even know what I'm looking at. What is happening to perspective here? All right. There was an artistic movement started in the Middle Ages that wasn't as concerned with perspective as it was some other things. And that's why when you look at old medieval art, it just looks like it's bad. But it's actually not bad. They're actually doing some things very intentionally. You just don't know to look for it. But these are two pages from two different medieval manuscripts. The one on the left is called The Ascension of Christ. The one on the left is called The Ascension of Christ, and it is from about 1340. The other one is from a prayer book. It's actually a book for, it was called A Book of Hours, and it's a book, among other things. This particular page is a prayer, and actually, if your Latin is really rusty, that's the text there on the right there is from Psalm 114. And this is from several pages in that particular book of prayers that were meant to be read at funerals. Let me tell you why they were meant to be read at funerals. Both of these two pages were created when Europe was going through two different bouts of what we now call the Black Death or the plague. Bubonic plague was sweeping through Europe, killing people in numbers that we cannot imagine today. Killing people in numbers that would make our recent Ebola scare look like the common cold. People were dying everywhere. And these two pages, which are from two different illuminated manuscripts, an illuminated manuscript is just a book, it's usually the Bible or a book of prayer, and then it's been filled in with all this sort of elaborate art, and that's what illumination means. An illuminated manuscript. Both of these were created by two masters. We know they were masters because they were prolific and their work was everywhere. But we don't know their names. Think about that for a moment. Here's two really remarkable pieces of art. And if you could look at them in closer detail and just see, I mean, a page like this takes weeks to produce and they made hundreds and hundreds of them. And we don't know who did this. We know that they were masters. We know that they were highly respected at the time. But the reason we don't know who did this is because they died in the plague. And nobody ever wrote their names down. But their work lived on past them. Now, these were men whose art they dedicated to Christ and the service of the church. These were men who gave their talents and their efforts in one of the most difficult and tragic times in human history, when people were dying around them. This guy said, you know what, I'm going to paint the ascension of Christ. And this other guy said, you know what, I'm going to do Psalm 114, which is a really joyful and triumphant psalm. You should go home and read it. We don't know their names, but the art that they made and the art that they left lives on today. And both of these pieces are in the Getty Museum, which has one of the largest collections of illuminated manuscripts in the world. Now, I could pull a much more prominent example for you. It's Christmas, and one of the works that we hear at Christmas a lot is Handel's Messiah, right? George Friedrich Handel, somebody who, we were talking about him at dinner last night, somebody who loved the Lord tremendously, and wanted to make a piece of art, in this case, the Messiah, and dedicate it, give his talents, give his gifts to the Lord. And Handel did that, and it is a piece of art that has stayed with us for hundreds of years since. So the art that you make will outlast you, and you should be very thoughtful and very intentional, not just about your content, but about your craft. Because if Christians are going to make art, it had better be the best art there is. Because otherwise the world's going to look at it and say, oh, well, you know, those Christians, they're making shoddy stuff and then, you know, saying it's great because it's, you know, because it's about their God, but why should we take that seriously? If you're going to make something and stamp the name of Jesus on it, you had better make it the best you can. So the art you make will outlast you. The words you say will outlast you. And the disciples that you make, the people that you reach, will outlast you. So what I want to ask you in closing this morning is, what does your handprint say? A minute ago, we talked about the pillars of stone at Gilgal and in the Jordan. And then we talked about these handprints on the wall of the cave. And I asked you to think about the difference between them. I'm going to tell you the difference that I see between these two different, they're both memorials. One of those memorials says, I existed, I was human. And there's a lot of memorials in history that say just that. There's a lot of memorials, like a statue of Ramses, broken, lying on the sands of Egypt, with the words carved at the base, look on my works, you mighty, in despair, that say, I existed, I was here, I did a thing. But the stones at Gilgal and the stones in the Jordan have a very different message. They say, Christ lived in me. Because of him, I was able to experience the fullness of everything that it means to be human. Because of Christ, Christ gave meaning to something that didn't have it before. There's a really marked difference between those two. And the thing is, you are leaving a handprint, or at least a footprint. Something you're doing is going to outlast you. But what does that handprint say? I want to give you three resolutions that I want to make for us as a class. Now, I told you, next Sunday we'll be back in the back. We'll have coffee. We'll have pastries. We're going to start in on the Gospel of John. I'm really, really excited about it. And I want to give you three resolutions that I want you to join me in this class for the coming year. The first one is to know Christ better through his life. We have seen Christ poured out before us, foreshadowed for us, illuminated for us by the Old Testament. Starting next week, we're going to be reading about his life. And so the first resolution is that as we look at this, that the only thing that we're there for, the only agenda that we have, is not to prove any points or satisfy any soapboxes or scratch any itches. The only agenda that we have is to know Jesus better by reading through his life as a class. Second thing that we're going to do is we're going to treat the word with reverence. We're going to read everything. We're going to talk about everything, even the hard stuff, even the confusing stuff, even the stuff that I don't know if I agree with that. I'm not sure that Jesus really means what it sounds like he means, because that's sort of uncomfortable to this other doctrine that I hold dear. We're not going to do any of that. We're going to treat the word with reverence. We're going to read stuff in context. We're going to talk about it. And we're not going to read in stuff that's not there, because it fits what we're looking for better. And the final thing that I want to encourage you to do, and here's the thing, I cannot do this without your help. You have to do this with me. And that is, we're going to search the word together as families. So every week, I'm going to give you reading. It's going to be up to you to go home and do the reading. It's not going to be long. You're going to read the passage for next week's lesson, and you're going to ask questions about it. All right? And that's going to be our homework every week. And I'm going to try to put in the extra effort and the extra time to make sure that every week we have homework. All right? That's my commitment to you. And what I need from you is a commitment to go home, to do the reading, to ask the questions. Not even answer the questions, because sometimes there are hard questions in the Bible, questions that I can't answer for you. But go home, do the reading, ask the questions. Treat it like it matters, because nothing else matters compared to this. When you leave your handprint, what will it say? Let's pray. Dear Lord, I am so...